True Crime Brewery contains disturbing content related to real-life crimes. Medical information is opinion based on facts of a crime and should not be interpreted as medical advice or treatment. Listener discretion is advised.
Welcome to True Crime Brewery. I'm Jill.
And I'm Dick.
Dr. Josephakis Joe Karalambis had a thriving family practice when he became obsessed with 15-year-old Shelley Joel. Shelley, along with other members of her family, was his patient. Shelley's parents were alarmed when the doctor began buying her gifts and calling her at home. He seemed to be obsessed with her, speaking of little else. And they soon came to believe that the doctor brainwashed Shelley, luring her into an inappropriate, illegal, and abusive relationship. As soon as Shelley was legally allowed, she married her doctor, but she didn't live happily ever after. After the wedding, Joe engaged with prostitutes, and his interest in young girls persisted. He soon became infatuated with two pretty young patients, Katie and Sean Simmons. But Katie and Sean weren't as easily brainwashed as Shelley had been. They told their father about their doctor's inappropriate remarks and behavior, and he contacted the College of Physicians and Surgeons, helping his daughters file a formal complaint for sexual misconduct. After Dr. Joe learned that the girls were scheduled to appear before the board, 19-year-old Sean Simmons was murdered in her own basement apartment. Join us at the quiet end for Just What the Doctor Ordered, an unbelievable story of a family physician willing to take a life to preserve his own career and reputation. Several people were not surprised that he was willing to take advantage of underage patients to satisfy his own sexual deviancies. But the idea that he would stoop to murder was shocking. And in a karmic twist, the doctor's young wife Shelley's testimony would be what did him in. So fascinating story.
It certainly is. Now we have a nice Canadian beer. I think we're in Western Canada for this tale, and my beer is from Quebec, but it was a great beer, so I wanted to put it in. So it's Doppelbach Grand Cuvée Printemps, spring beer. It's brewed by the Three Musketeers in Brossard, Quebec. So it's a double buck. It's 8.6% alcohol by volume. These are kind of sweet beers, and this is no exception. This beer is a dark brown color, a little tan head, nice aroma, some bread, fruit, maybe a hint of chocolate. Then there's a taste of cocoa, plum, pumpernickel bread, and caramel. How's that?
Well, it's delicious. I actually believe I did drink this beer a couple years ago.
And we've had some, yes.
Yeah, and it's almost very desserty, very dessert-like beer, so yeah. I did enjoy it.
It's a nice beer.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's open it up. So down here at the quiet end. Before we begin, I'd like to express our appreciation to John Griffiths, the author of a book which we used in our research on this case. It's titled Fatal Prescription. The book includes extensive research on this case, and we'd also recommend it to anyone who wants to learn more on the case. So we'll provide a link to John Griffiths' book in our show notes. So this is a very fascinating case. I'm happy that we're going to talk about it. There may be some pronunciation issues for me a couple times, and I apologize in advance, but I am doing my best. So I'd like to get into it right away.
Right away, yes.
Right away. It's just so fascinating. Very sad, of course, but just the whole story. Some people in this world just blow my mind.
Well, and you'll have your mind continue to be blown. There's
yes.
always surprises out there.
There are, and those are the kind of cases that fascinate me.
So Joe Karalambis was born on April 5th, 1952, on the island nation of Cyprus in the Mediterranean. He was the second child of Petru and Eleodoros Karalambis. And he was raised in a home that had dirt floors and no modern appliances. Now, Joe was especially close to his mother. His memories of his father was that of a selfish and controlling man who he both feared and hated. And when Joe was growing up, Cyprus was a fairly dangerous place to be living. A lot of violence between rival factions of Turks and Greeks, and they were both battling to replace the British administration. Beside all this, though, Joe is proud of his being a Cypriot. And when he was 8 years old, his parents immigrated to Canada, and they settled in Vancouver, British Columbia. Eliodorus had moved to Canada to start his own watch repair business, and then he sent for his family to join him. Eliodorus had a Canadian girlfriend who tried her best to persuade him to leave his wife where she was, but Petru and the children did ultimately join her husband in Canada in 1960, and the family settled in North Burnaby, which is a middle-class Vancouver neighborhood.
Yeah, so this family was traditional and absolutely patriarchal. But Joe's sister Susan aspired to be an actress. She enrolled in theater classes in Los Angeles. The youngest child, Harry, grew up to be taller than Joe, but Joe was always the most outspoken of his siblings, and he would tease them constantly about their relationships with the opposite sex. So from a very young age, Joe was very motivated. He studied hard in school, and then after school he would pick beans to earn money. But he always had to be in control, so he was really more like his father than he would admit. Neighbors often heard yelling and loud arguments coming from the Carolambus house. Joe saw his father abusing his brother and his sister, but the abuse was almost always directed at them, not Joe. Over the next few years, it became apparent that Eliodorus was more interested in his freedom than in his family. He was handsome and charming, skilled at hiding his arrogance and hostility to get what he wanted. He would sometimes disappear for days, just returning home when he needed money for drink, women, and gambling. So even though Joe grew to despise his father, he emulated his air of self-confidence. Joe was considered to be smooth by his peers, especially the girls. Many of them found him to be fun and charming. He always seemed to get dates with the best-looking girls in the neighborhood, and he would end up with the girl considered to be the best-looking blonde in his junior high school. But one thing he could never accept was rejection. He once threatened a girl's family after she broke up with him. So he had a mean side to his personality, and even as a teen, he thought becoming a doctor would get him the most attractive girls.
Yeah, so who cares about doing good for humanity or kind of being a good citizen and healing others? If I'm a doctor, I can hustle young women. So that's the way to do it.
Well, I bet there are a percentage of people in med school that are definitely going for that. The money or the chicks or whatever, the prestige.
Money and prestige, yeah. You can find good-looking women any place. You don't have to go to med school for that.
That's true, and actually he would figure that out. Joe wanted to be a doctor from the time he was little. He wanted to be accepted and looked up to, especially by women. And while he was in school, Joe began to study karate, and this would become a lifelong passion. Joe and his sister Susan ended up telling their father to leave the family home. And after that, Eliodorus lived alone, sleeping in the back of his watchmaker's shop. Eliodorus wasn't able to provide any support to the family, so Joe's mother worked as a seamstress in her home, later taking a job as a housekeeper at the International Plaza Hotel. So she ended up filing for divorce in 1974, and once the marriage was over, she decided to do whatever was necessary to help Joe with his career, even mortgaging her modest house. "My son Joseph the doctor," she would say later, just overwhelmed with pride. He could do no wrong in her eyes.
And Joe's mother liked to see her son as being very different from his father, but others saw a lot of similarities. While he did manage to avoid his father's addictions to liquor and cigarettes, he was compulsive about his own passions. One of those was karate. He was obsessed with karate. He learned special breathing techniques. He learned how to deliver blows with speed, strength, and unpredictability. Soon he was teaching karate, and he showed students the most vulnerable parts of the body, face, neck, spine, groin, and kidneys. It seemed a little strange for a medical student to speak about the human body in that way.
Yeah, these two things, you know, wanting to be a doctor and karate, certainly they could be compatible, but there were some things that really conflicted there that didn't make a lot of sense. Now, many of his students were young women, and as the sensei, Joe was given a high degree of respect. And of course, he enjoyed this power, not only over his young female students, but also over some of their mothers. and they considered him to be attractive. But they were expendable because his career always came first. At the University of British Columbia, many of the other medical students thought Joe was terribly arrogant. But Joe claimed that they were prejudiced against his ethnic background, so he devoted his spare time to karate. Once Joe became a doctor, he became completely self-centered and very pretentious. He'd say things like, "Oh, I've had a $20,000 week." It seemed odd and really distasteful that he was in this helping profession, thinking about people's lives in terms of the money that he earned. But, you know, that's just the kind of guy he was. Once he called up a friend's estranged wife and asked her out behind the friend's back. Another time, he got permission from a rival Taekwondo school to sign up some students for a karate tournament, and he used the information he got on the students to ask one of the young teenage students out on a date. Now, the owner of the academy was offended when he learned that Joe had used personal information to target a young girl, but it was really just par for the course for Joe, the kind of thing he'd just kind of shrug his shoulders about.
Yeah, and by the time any of this happened, Joe had already had several run-ins with the law. In 1978, as a young medical student, he was put on probation for 1 year after being convicted for common assault. He had punched a woman in the face at her house. Now, he'd had a drink with her 2 weeks earlier, and the woman had declined to see him again. But Joe didn't want to take that for an answer.
No, he was very angry. It's a dangerous man.
In January of 1979, he was still on probation when the Vancouver police were called at 1 o'clock in the morning to an apartment he was renting. Two men had attempted to take his TV as payment for services by a prostitute he had refused to pay. Joe had run into his bedroom, grabbed his gun, and fired a warning shot. Then he fired a second shot and hit one of the men in the hand. So after that incident, his fellow medical students asked the dean of medicine to expel him.
Yep, and I don't know why they didn't, because there were certainly some red flags.
I mean, those two things right there
would be
enough.
Mm-hmm.
Then in August, a police officer was driving at 2:30 in the morning when a prostitute stepped off the sidewalk and waved him down. The woman said she'd been performing fellatio in a male customer's car when this man suddenly turned on her, hitting her in the head and pulling her hair. And she gave the policeman the license number of the car. And when the officer checked it out, he found that the car was registered to Joe Karalambas. But nothing got done about the complaint.
Well, no, because she's just a prostitute, right? And that was the whole idea of it.
Yeah, and he's an important medical student.
Right.
So Joe graduated from the University of British Columbia Medical School in 1981, and he interned at Royal Columbian Hospital in New Westminster. It was there that he bragged that he slept with a different nurse every night of the week. Everyone wants to screw a doctor, he is fond of saying.
Well, yeah, you tell me that constantly. And I say, Dick, come on. Come on, Dick, be real.
I know. It's just those old brain cells working or something. I don't know.
So let's go to 1985, when Joe was running his own family medicine practice. He was 33 when he became obsessed with 15-year-old Shelley Joel. After divorcing her first husband, Doug Joel, after a 10-year marriage, Jacqueline Youngkind, Shelley's mother, received custody of her daughters, Shelley and Shauna. She soon remarried her second husband, Richard Youngkind. So Dr. Joe delivered their baby, and Richard began seeing Joe for a sports injury. Richard also sought counseling and marital advice from the doctor, who was less than helpful. But he just had such a big ego, he would not make a referral to a counselor. He said, I can handle it. But feeling depressed after separating from his wife, Richard decided he'd make another appointment to see the doctor. But then he was stunned that the doctor was only interested in talking to him about his stepdaughter, Shelley. It was downright creepy. Each time he tried to discuss his own problems, the doctor would change the subject to Shelley. So Richard said, wow, I'm done, and he never returned to that practice. But while she and her husband were separated, Jacqueline went back to work as a waitress. And during this time, Shelley babysat her younger brothers. She'd always been an easy, cooperative child, but then she began to argue and rebel, so something was going on. Then in late 1984, Shelley confided to her mother that 2 years earlier, when she was just 12, she'd been raped by a male boarder in their home. So Jacqueline called the doctor, who offered counseling to her daughter. He brought up the rape during Shelley's next visit to his office, but she refused to discuss it with him. And I really can't blame her. That doesn't seem like the best person for a young girl to talk to, especially considering what a pedophile he really was.
Yeah, but, I mean, they didn't know that.
They didn't. But, you know, when a girl is only 12 and she's raped, that really makes her vulnerable. We have to factor that into this whole situation. I'm sure he recognized that. But undeterred, Joe invited her to his house for a party for his karate students. Shelley told the doctor she had to work that night at a restaurant, though, but he continued to come after her and invite her over, no matter how many times she declined his invitations. She started avoiding his calls, but then he showed up at the pizza place where she was working and just obviously was continuing to pursue her.
So it doesn't sound like Shelley was that enamored of him, at least early on in this relationship.
No, I think it was very overwhelming. But still, Shelley was taken to Dr. Joe again when her mother caught her in her bedroom with her boyfriend and insisted that Shelley needed to get a prescription for birth control pills. Later, after the doctor learned that Shelley and her boyfriend had broken up, he invited her out to coffee and lunch with him. He assured the very leery Jacqueline that his interest in her daughter was purely professional. But Jacqueline became concerned when he started calling Shelley almost every day at home, inviting Jacqueline and Shelley to his home to discuss the family's issues over dinner and drinks. So this is just something that doesn't happen, shouldn't happen. It's highly unusual.
Well, it's highly unusual.
And I would imagine it's frowned upon.
Right.
Yep.
It is. And it does happen, though. It'd be nice to say it never happens, but
well,
it does.
Well, sure. Yeah. But he was really kind of on the far end of normalcy here. Really kind of crazy.
Oh, yeah.
And Jacqueline did have some idea. She was declining the invitations, but he was very persistent. He just didn't give up. So she finally asked him, "Why are you so interested in my daughter? For one thing, you're her doctor. You're in your 30s and she's 15. She's far too young to be seeing a person of your age and you've got nothing in common." And he just kind of laughed it off. He did not give a shit what Jacqueline thought.
No, even though she's point on in her observations.
Absolutely.
So Jacqueline decided, well, I'm going to find a new doctor for Shelley.
That's good choice,
a good idea. However, before that happened, Shelley, who had asthma, suffered a severe asthma attack, maybe the worst yet in her lifetime. And she was sick enough to be hospitalized and was sick enough to be kept in the ICU overnight. And since the family hadn't found a new doctor yet, Jacqueline spoke on the phone with Dr. Joe. And he told her, well, he'd been notified that Shelley was in the hospital and that he'd be seeing her during his morning rounds.
So, yeah, he's still her primary care doctor. So that makes sense.
Right.
And as was expected, Shelley's condition improved over the next few days. Then when Jacqueline came to see her daughter after work, she found her bedside table covered with gifts, magazines, and candy. And Shelley explained that the gifts were from the doctor. Now, she's just a kid, really. What does she know? She was happy and giggling about it. She was enjoying the attention.
Well, sure.
But Jacqueline was disturbed. She told Shelley that she shouldn't accept any more gifts from him. And at home that night, Jacqueline had difficulty sleeping. She was worried about this. The next day, Shelley was discharged from the hospital, and that evening, Shelley told her mother that Dr. Joe wanted to see her again the following day.
Yes, and this wasn't just for a follow-up.
No, we understand that.
So Dr. Joe was beginning his vacation, and he wanted to pick up Shelley and take her to the horse races. Jacqueline can't believe what she's hearing. I mean, jeez, the doctor had been caring for her family for years. She told Shelley that she was not allowed to go anywhere with him. And although she didn't have a home phone at the time, Jacqueline did get a call at work the next day from her younger daughter, Shauna. Shauna had run next door to use a neighbor's phone to call her mom. And she wanted Jacqueline to know that Dr. Joe was at the house having coffee, and he is planning to take Shelley out for lunch and a movie.
So he's just crazy. I mean, no boundaries here. No respect for Jacqueline as a mother at all.
None whatsoever.
And she was livid. She told Shauna, "You keep Shelley home. But that didn't work, of course. When she got home, Shelley and the doctor had left. What was Shauna going to do about it?
Right. Nothing.
Nothing.
So Shelley got home finally that night at 11:30, and she is all giggly and excited. She had $350, which she claimed she'd won at the horse races. Calling the doctor by his first name, she told her mother, "Joe pays for the bets for me." Jacqueline insisted that she return the money the next day. But her once obedient daughter was becoming more defiant. Shelley told her mother that she was a grown woman and she could make her own decisions.
So Shelley's behavior is pretty much understandable for her age and level of maturity. But what would you do in this circumstance? As a mother, I don't know what I'd do. I think
I would call the police, or I would call the medical board, or both.
Yes. And I think now in 2021, it would be much easier to nip this in the bud.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah. And Jacqueline didn't really know what to do. But Shelley said she only wanted to see the doctor over the summer just for fun, and it certainly wouldn't become sexual.
Yeah, I can hear that conversation.
Yeah.
Don't worry, Mom, I won't have sex with him.
So I guess Jacqueline decided she'd believe this. Maybe it was just easier to do that, at least for the time being. She was also afraid of alienating her daughter, so she did offer up a compromise. She said if it were just a temporary thing, then Shelley could go out with the doctor during the daytime, and she could go to his karate classes twice a week. But this would have to stop when Shelley went back to school in the fall. But of course, good old Dr. Joe would disregard Jacqueline's rules. He knew that Shelley had been grounded for a week for coming home late from a date with him, but he took her out again the next day anyway. Then he called up Jacqueline at her work, telling her in a very patronizing tone that in his country, they have no such thing as grounding a person. He told her that she didn't own her daughter and couldn't make decisions for her. Then he glibly explained how he would be taking Shelley shopping to help him pick out some clothes, followed by a romantic dinner. Can you believe the nerve of this guy? He was just completely disregarding Jacqueline and her concerns.
Yeah, so Jacqueline did threaten to complain to the medical board, get his license to practice medicine taken away. That didn't seem to faze Dr. Joe. He told Jacqueline that he would be with Shelley, and there's nothing you can do about it. Nya, nya, nya.
Crazy, huh? Just crazy. So at home that night, the doctor asked Shelley to join him in his hot tub. He told her that if a man didn't have sex at least every other day, the buildup of seminal fluid could cause him to have a fatal stroke.
Well, that's
pretty
true,
well
right? Known.
Yeah, you told me that.
I know. I've told you that many times.
No, that's absolute hogwash, right?
Right.
So Shelley didn't have a bathing suit with her, but she didn't want him to have a stroke. So the poor girl took off her jeans and got in the tub with this man, and he seduced her. And he told her, "If you don't have sex with me, I'll just find a new girlfriend." So feeling guilty because he'd spent a lot of money on her, she was just an easy target. He knew what he was doing. And once he had what he wanted, he told her, "It's time to get dressed." And then hearing the doctor's car pull up at Shelley's house at around 11:30 p.m., Shelley's stepfather, Richard, stormed out of the house and ordered Shelley to go inside. And then he confronted the doctor.
Yeah, Dr. Joe was pretty calm and cool about this. He actually told Richard that most people would pay him to go out with their daughter. According to him, he was doing Shelley a favor by taking her out and teaching her new things.
What a champ.
It's nice of him. He said that he was helping her become more confident.
He's actually destroying her self-esteem and hurting her badly. Let's just say that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And inside the house, Shelley told her mother that they were not having sex. I hope she had her fingers crossed when she did that. And that Dr. Joe was going to help her become a model or an actress. He had told her that he had a sister in L.A. who could get her jobs.
So he's just playing everything in the book here as a pedophile. Right? Giving her money, making her feel guilty, the whole line about
he has to have sex.
Yeah. Yep. So, of course, he didn't stop seeing her in the fall, as had been promised. On September 9th that year, Jacqueline got into an argument with her daughter for coming home after her 10 p.m. school night curfew, and Shelley stormed out of the house. Her stepfather got in his car and went looking for her, and he found her at a phone booth. But then Dr. Joe showed up and she hopped into his car, so she clearly called him. Richard chased after them but lost them after Dr. Joe sped through two red lights. Richard went to the police station to make a statement. Jacqueline woke up the next morning and Shelley still was not home. So she called the doctor's house when she got to work. The doctor answered and told her that Shelley was sleeping and she'd be staying with him. Again, he told Jacqueline that she couldn't do anything about this. So a couple of days later, Jacqueline went to the doctor's house to speak with Shelley, and Dr. Joe did leave them alone to talk for a little bit. But Shelley refused to return home, and when the doctor got back, he was cruel to Jacqueline. He told her that she was not supportive and she was just not a good mother, and it was all her fault that her daughter had left home. So Jacqueline was devastated, but really didn't know what to do. It seemed like this man had totally brainwashed her daughter. Richard, the stepfather, had been to the police, but they wouldn't do anything. But by September 20th, the police did do something. Jacqueline learned that a Los Angeles woman named Barbara had also complained about Dr. Joe. And I'm going to tell you right now, there were several women who complained. We just don't have time to go into all of them. A constable, Tom Robertson, had gone to the doctor's house to charge him with sexual assault. And Robertson had learned that the doctor was living with this teenage patient, Shelley, and had arranged for the police to take her back to the police station if they found her at his house. So Shelley called Jacqueline's neighbor from the doctor's house to tell her that Joe had been taken away in handcuffs. She was crying, and she thought her mother was behind this arrest. The police would only release her into her mother's custody, and Jacqueline arrived at the station and told Shelley that she knew nothing about the arrest. She had to wait there while police interviewed Joe and Shelley in separate rooms. And while waiting, Jacqueline decided to talk to Dr. Joe's mother, who was also waiting there. And all she said was, "Joe's a good boy." Jacqueline tried to reason with her, but made absolutely no progress. And apart from this Barbara's case, the police were determining whether they could get enough evidence to charge Joe for having sex with Shelley, clearly a minor.
But Shelley wasn't willing to testify against Joe in court. So Shelley was sent home in custody of her mother, and the police officers told Shelley that she would be placed in foster care if they found her with the doctor again. But the best course of action, the police told Jacqueline, was to file an official complaint with the College of Physicians and Surgeons. Good advice.
Now, is that something we have here by a different name?
Sure. State Board of Medical Examiners.
Okay.
Back at home, her sister Shauna was thrilled to have Shelley back. She had always looked up to her. And after they reunited, Shelley admitted it had been wrong for her to stay with the doctor. At one point, she told Shauna, Joe had warned her to never tell anyone about what was said or done in his house. And during the next week, Shelley visited a new family doctor who was a woman.
Good choice, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And on September 24th, Jacqueline and her husband made an official complaint to the College of Physicians and Surgeons.
So do you feel like a guy like this kind of ruins things for decent doctors like yourself?
I don't know that he ruins things, but he certainly taints the profession.
Well, I think it does, and I think it's harder for people to trust their physician when you read about people like this. Well, I mean, just like any bad apple in any profession really ruins things for the others.
Exactly.
Or makes it more difficult. But the registrar of the British Columbia College of Physicians and Surgeons had definitely seen a lot of complaints. But these allegations of the brazen behavior by a physician really upset them. So the registrar told Jacqueline and her husband that if their report was accurate, he agreed with them about the outrageously inappropriate behavior of Shelley's doctor. Although they were busy with about 500 complaints a year, he wanted the college investigator to begin investigations on this one immediately. Now, about 10% of the complaints to the college concerned sexual misconduct, because most of them were allegations of incompetence. But this complaint was one of the worst in his career.
Yeah, under the Medical Practitioners Act, a physician's license could not be revoked prior to a hearing unless the doctor was either mentally unstable or his patients were at risk of malpractice. So while the self-regulating college did have the right to discipline and remove fellow doctors, legal considerations meant lengthy delays before actions could be taken. And the investigation began, and the Yonkines met with a lawyer. But not long after that happened, Jacqueline became suspicious that Shelley had begun seeing Dr. Joe again. Her suspicions were confirmed one night when she saw Dr. Joe dropping her daughter off in front of the house. After an argument the next day, Shelley said she was going out for a walk, and she didn't come back.
Yeah, so this is devastating for the family. For the rest of the year, Shelley lived with her aunt in Vancouver, and none of her family members knew that she was regularly giving the doctor oral sex after school. Now, the doctor was angry that she'd signed a statement at the police station, and he had ripped up some of her clothing and her school books. But Shelley's in a bad situation, and she didn't tell anyone about it. Then in January, when Shelley turned 16, the doctor told her that she could drive one of his cars to her modeling classes, which he would pay for. Jacqueline spoke to officials at the college again, and they advised her that the investigation had found evidence enough to refer the case for an official inquiry. But Shelley was slipping away from her family, and that's the really sad thing here. Dr. Joe had called her at her aunt's house in January 1986 and had told her to pack a bag, and Shelley had agreed, and she left with him. Ignoring her family, now she was living with the doctor again. Jacqueline's at the end of her rope. She drove to Vancouver's Mount Pleasant Hooker District to talk to some of the girls because she knew that Dr. Joe frequented the area looking for prostitutes. She then went and spoke to some of his former girlfriends and listened to the complaints of Barbara from L.A. Jacqueline was completely cut off from Shelley for the next 2 months, but Shauna did sometimes see her at school. Shelley got to use Joe's black Nissan that spring, and she took Shauna out for rides. But Shauna saw her sister was living in a really different world, and it was very awkward. A school counselor told Jacqueline one day that Shelley was transferring to another school that was closer to the doctor's house. The counselor said that Shelley seemed unhappy about the situation, but suggested that the family could only be there for her and show her that they loved her no matter what, kind of saying there's nothing they could do about this legally, which is just outrageous.
Well, don't they have statutory rape laws in Canada?
I don't know what was going on here with that. I would think they do. But it seems like, because she was a teenager and, I don't know, an older teenager, I guess. Yeah. Not really, though. They were letting this go to a large extent, partially because he's, you know, kind of a bigwig. I don't know. But Shelley told her sister that she could no longer drop by each day and drive her to school, either. She'd promised Dr. Joe that she would stop speaking to her sister. Actually, the doctor had forbidden Shelley from speaking to anyone without his permission. He was super controlling. Shelley refused to elaborate with her sister on why this was happening or why she was agreeing to this. But there was definitely abuse, emotional, mental, and physical also. And meanwhile, Dr. Joe insisted that Shelley had to be with him while he enjoyed horse racing, karate, and gambling. He introduced her to his friends, adding a year to her age and telling everyone she was 17. Like that would make it okay.
I was going to say, that's so much better than being a 16-year-old.
Yeah, right. Oh, she's 17? Sure. Yeah. So while playing cards at his mother's house, Joe introduced her to this tattooed biker named Brian West, who he called his best friend. He and West had been like brothers since he took one of Joe's karate classes in 1971. In addition to knowing karate, West was also a boxer, and he was trouble. He was very into drugs. So these were an odd couple, the doctor and the biker. But as you can imagine, Dr. Joe didn't fit in with the other doctors.
Certainly not.
No.
Now, on August 1st, 1986, and this was almost a year after the Yonkines had made their official complaint, they received a registered letter from their lawyer advising them of the college's intention to go ahead with a hearing. According to the letter, the doctor had breached his professional relationship with Shelley. Well, no shit. The college had taken the complaint seriously.
Had they, though? I don't know. It seems a little slow to me.
Slow serious.
Yes.
In the letter to Dr. Joe, they wrote, "You cohabitated and had sexual intercourse with her. in relation to the foregoing facts, you have been guilty of infamous or unprofessional conduct.
Sure.
So when his hearing in front of the board came up, Shelley agreed to stick by the doc. Shelley had promised she wouldn't leave him facing the hearing alone. If it would save his practice, she'd tell the college that she loved him, and her mother had needlessly caused trouble. Now, the reality of the situation was that Shelley felt trapped. She really wanted to be home with her family. She missed Shauna. She missed her brothers. But things had gotten to a point and gone so far that she didn't know what to do. Now, Dr. Joe had rehearsed her story with her over and over and over, and he had almost convinced Shelley that he had done nothing wrong.
So I don't understand why it would matter to them if she was in love with him and wanted to be with him.
I don't know what that's going to gain.
Well, it seems to be a thing here, which is disturbing. So he took comfort in the fact that the hearing was held behind closed doors, at least. According to the college, this was done to protect the privacy of patients, but critics believe that the lack of public exposure gave undeserved protection to guilty doctors. Jacqueline told the committee how the doctor had defied her parental decisions, then used his personal knowledge of the family to seduce her teenage daughter. Since then, Jacqueline explained, the doctor had prohibited Shelley from having any contact with her family. He had threatened to portray her as an unfit mother. But she was determined, and she explained how she had been just appalled by his conduct. When she testified, Shelley admitted that she was living with the doctor as common law husband and wife. Originally, she said, the doctor had asked her if she had her mother's permission to go out with him, and she'd told him that she did. She'd had dinner with him at the racetrack, but had never gambled. Dr. Joe had stopped being her doctor before she moved in with him. In response to questions, Shelley stuck by her story that she loved the doctor and planned to marry him. She testified her mother was always going out with different men and having them stay overnight at the family home. In comparison, she testified, life with Dr. Joe was stable. If she were unable to live with him, she said, she wouldn't return to her mother's home. So this was just heartbreaking for her family.
Must have been, you know?
Absolutely.
Now, when he was questioned, Dr. Joe acknowledged that it was as their doctor that he had learned about the Yonkind family background. He believed the family was disorganized and in economic turmoil, but he claimed that he had encouraged Shelley's mother and stepfather to maintain the family unit. He confirmed that he had prescribed birth control pills for Shelley in 1985, but added he'd been living with another girl until the summer and didn't think about dating Shelley until he discharged her from the hospital after her asthma admission.
I don't see how any of this even matters.
It doesn't.
No, it shouldn't, and I don't think today it would. But obviously things were different in the 80s. As the board considered their decision, Shelley and Joe left for Las Vegas to be married. This was March 1987, and the doctor changed Shelley's birth certificate to show that she was 19, not 17. He had actually re-laminated it after changing the birth date, but the type didn't match, and it really wasn't a great job. No one seemed to notice or care, though. As the minister recited the vows, Shelley giggled nervously, and after that, they went out for breakfast. Shelley told her new husband she'd rather spend the morning shopping than gambling, and he got angry, so he said, "See you back at the hotel. I'm going to the casino." So Shelley spent the rest of her wedding day walking around the hotel by herself. Now she felt really trapped. Her mother, Jacqueline, sent flowers to the couple when she learned about this marriage 2 weeks later. But others in the family could see that she was very sad, of course. Since her daughter had been lured into a relationship with Dr. Joe, the family vehicles had been vandalized, and the family experienced a terrifying house fire. Also, they had virtually no contact with Shelley. There were also signs that Shelley was being physically abused by her husband, and they knew that he was continuing to pay prostitutes for sex. So after returning to work, the doctor was happily surprised that most of his patients were staying with him, despite this scandal. The doctor explained to his patient, Chris Simmons, that he was in love with his wife, and that marriage to a younger woman was just a Greek tradition. Unaware of all the details, Chris Simmons saw no reason to doubt him and continued to be his patient.
Chris Simmons' daughters, Sean and Katie Simmons, had a happy childhood. They were well protected by their loving parents. And as teens, the girls were close, and they both had promising futures. Katie was 18 months older than her sister, and remembered other kids teasing Sean at elementary school because she wore glasses and was a little bit overweight. But when Sean went to high school, she seemed to have changed overnight. She was a striking girl with long, beautiful hair. Her family physician, Dr. Joe, noticed that both of the Simmons girls were beautiful, and like he had with his young wife Shelley, he decided to act on his sexual attraction.
Yikes. This episode is sponsored by Apostrophe, a prescription skincare company for people who are ready to take their acne seriously. Fun fact, most home remedies and over-the-counter acne products don't work. And even worse, they can really damage your skin. Brings me back to when I was a tween, which is a very long time ago. My sister told me that if I put antibiotic ointment on my skin, I wouldn't have any breakouts. Well, in case you're wondering, it didn't work. My skin was very shiny, but I still got pimples. Where was a dermatologist when I really needed one? Well, now I can consult with a board-certified dermatologist online. Ah, progress. Prescription acne treatment can be hard to get. You have to take time off of work, see a doctor, and line up at the pharmacy to get the actual medication. Not so with Apostrophe. Apostrophe connects you with a board-certified dermatologist who will create a personalized treatment plan that is perfectly tailored to your unique skin, with no office visit and no trip to the pharmacy. Simply fill out Apostrophe's online quiz about your skin goals and medical history, then you snap a few selfies, and your dermatologist will create your customized treatment plan right then. The best part is that Apostrophe offers topical and oral medications, so you can treat your acne from the inside out or from the outside in. Apostrophe treats acne, and they can also help you hit your other skincare goals. Apostrophe has helped me out with a prescription strength cream to lighten dark spots, as well as prevent acne outbreaks. My prescription cream came in an easy-to-use pump bottle, and it arrived at my front door just days after my online visit. Even better, we have a special deal for our audience. Save $15 off your first visit with a board-certified dermatologist at apostrophe.com/TCB when you use our code TCB. This code is only available to our listeners. To get started, just go to apostrophe.com/TCB and click Begin Visit, then use our code TCB at sign up and you'll get your $15 off your dermatology visit. That's apostrophe.com/TCB and use that code TCB to get your dermatology visit and save $15. And we thank Apostrophe for sponsoring this podcast.
So back to the story. Chris and Susan Simmons had been married in November 1966 in England. Two of Sue's sisters moved to Australia, but Chris had wanted to move to Canada since he was a schoolboy. So the couple sold much of their belongings and moved to Vancouver. It was October 1968 when Chris Simmons found a job with the Iron Workers Union. And outside of working hours, Chris was interested in martial arts. He joined a judo club, and he actually went on to represent British Columbia as a middleweight contender in the national championships. Then he had a serious accident at work. He had been laid off, but he found a new job as a maintenance mechanic. And in June of 1971, Chris and Susan had a daughter. They named her Katie. And in January 1973, on her Aunt Sean's 16th birthday, Chris and Sue had another daughter, who was named Sean after her aunt. And less than 2 months later, the new baby's Aunt Sean was killed in a car crash. So Sue was a devoted mother. Sean was a good baby, much as Katie had been, and soon she was sleeping through the night. On her first birthday, Chris Simmons started a new job at Canada Safeway, and he continued to work there as his daughters grew up. 4 years later, the family bought a lot where they built a split-level home with 3 bedrooms. So Katie and Sean Simmons had been patients of Dr. Joe since the early 1980s, when they were 11 and 13. The girls seemed to like him well enough, as did most of his patients. Now, he sometimes seemed overly affectionate, but they had no reason to be suspicious of his motives. He seemed like a friendly man, and they respected him as their family doctor.
Well, by March 25th of 1988, more than 12 months had passed since Dr. Joe's inquiry committee hearing. Shelley had a baby by then, and she brought the baby with her to hear about her husband's fate. Crying, Shelley had called her mother at home the week before to say that she could visit her and the baby if she'd put in a good word for the doctor prior to the verdict. So Richard and Jacqueline talked it over, and they agreed that they would do what they could so they could see their grandchild. When Jacqueline addressed the college, she urged them to allow the doctor to keep his medical license. If we'd known he was truly in love with Shelley and not just toying with our emotions, we wouldn't have objected, she told them. And now that they're married, we don't want him to lose his practice. So the inquiry committee's report substantiated that the doctor had showed contempt for the Yonkines' parental authority and that he had exacerbated the family's problems. But it stopped short of condemning him. As she left the boardroom, Jacqueline felt like the college was skeptical, but was considering the possibility that her daughter's affair had been based on genuine attraction. So they found that the doctor was guilty of infamous conduct as charged, and they voted to suspend him from practice. But they didn't revoke his license entirely, so he was given a second chance. After serving his suspension, his name would be entered in a temporary register, and he would have to take a course in medical ethics and pay a $10,000 fine. He was also ordered to pay $20,000 in court costs. Jacqueline told the media that her opinion of the doctor had not changed, but that she didn't want to damage her daughter's future. She said, "It's out of love for our daughter that we don't want to get involved now. We're willing to accept him into our family if that's what she wants."
Well, that must have been a tough situation for those parents.
I know, and I can kind of understand why they did what they did. If she's going to stay with this man and she's having babies with him and they're married, if you want to maintain a relationship with her, you might have to sacrifice your true feelings about it for her sake.
Yes, you would. And I suppose also you could figure this marriage can't possibly last. So if we remain on semi-good terms with our daughter, when the marriage does break up, we'll be there for her.
Oh, I'd absolutely be thinking that as a mother, yes. And if you're going to argue about it and try and get him in more trouble, you really are going to push her away more, unfortunately, because he certainly deserved to be in more trouble. There's no doubt about that.
No question. Now, according to Shelley, Dr. Joe was angry and humiliated as he began serving his six-month suspension on January 1st, 1989. He was forced to mortgage his house for a second time, but he kept his office by renting it for $1,500 a month to another doctor who worked in the same building. Then he recorded a new outgoing message on his phone answering machine, which gave the impression that he was on vacation. Now, officials found out about this, a little bit of subterfuge, and insisted that the message be deleted. Now, Shelley noticed a big change in her husband after the decision. He became withdrawn, and he no longer invited karate students over to the house. He found the suspension traumatic, and he blamed it all on Jacqueline and Richard Yonkind. And for the family's safety, Richard took a job transfer to Alberta.
Yeah, I mean, this is a scary guy. They believe he started a fire. And they had two little boys at home.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like a good situation.
No, it's terrible. Now, when the doctor returned from his suspension, his practice, though, was thriving. And Shelley had to listen to him as he bragged about how much he cared for his patients. But, you know, many of them did distrust him almost as much as she did. Instead of wearing lab coats or nurses' uniforms, the doctor had his assistants wear high heels and miniskirts. So this must have been quite a place. So a patient said that Dr. Joe once told her that she could get marijuana and cocaine by coming to him rather than buying it on the street. He also seemed to have developed some strange diagnostic tools. Even when they went to see him with a completely unrelated complaint like a sore throat or a sprained ankle, several of his young female patients said that he asked them if they were happy with their sex lives. So he's just a creep.
Total. when Sean and Katie Simmons' parents took a trip to England to visit family, Dr. Joe called the house to check on Sean. She hadn't been sick, but Dr. Joe seemed to be suggesting that he make a house call. Then in September of 1991, the two sisters shared their similar disturbing experience they'd had through the years on their visits to the doctor. Just after New Year's, Katie said to Sean, I told him I had quit smoking, and he put his arms around me and gave me a big wet kiss. It was gross.
Yeah, I bet.
And Sean nodded. He did that to me, too. I never realized it when we were younger, but now I can see he's always been way too friendly. Sean's boyfriend was shocked when she told him that her family doctor had made passes at her, and he wanted to confront the doctor. But Sean convinced him it wasn't a good idea. Instead, Sean and Katie discussed the issue with their father, Chris, and he quickly filed a formal complaint with the British Columbia College of Physicians and Surgeons. And when he received the complaint, the college registrar, Dr. Tom Handley, realized that it had been only 2 years since Dr. Joe had finished serving his suspension. My, oh, my. The registrar was so surprised that he made sure the complaint was put on the agenda for the next meeting. I guess they weren't used to doctors backsliding that way.
Well, no, there are norms in society, you know, in different aspects of society, like medicine, politics, the law. And when people don't conform to those norms, sometimes it seems like we don't know how to react because it's just something unexpected. And it seems like this is what was going on. They were surprised by this. They had really expected him to fall into line. Because you work a long time to get that medical license. Do you really want to keep risking it?
Right. You don't want to kick it away?
No, but this thing with young girls, it's really a compulsion with him. Because he already has the young wife at home. That's not enough.
Well, she must be all of 20 by now, right?
Yeah. So Shelley didn't think her husband was too worried when he told her about the new complaint against him. He did admit to her that he had phoned Sean at home while her parents were in England, but he denied that he had fondled or kissed either of the sisters in his office. And then he said, well, even if I did kiss them, it was no big deal. So from Shelley's perspective, he seemed to think these complaints would end up being dropped before a hearing would even be scheduled. But he was very wrong. At this point, Shelley was pregnant and depressed. The doctor had been with prostitutes and was experiencing pain when he went to the bathroom. So Shelley wanted to leave him more than ever. He never tried to please her, but he expected her to do everything for him. So without apologizing or attempting any explanation for whatever kind of infection he brought home some antibiotics and gave Shelley and himself injections at home.
Yeah, it sounds like a little bit of sexually transmitted infection going on there.
Absolutely, it does. Now, after her baby girl was born a few days later, Shelley did have her examined by another doctor because she was worried about the infection. And this doctor found no complications, but was certainly appalled to hear that Shelley had received a home injection from her husband for this. And Shelley felt betrayed by her husband. On March 30th, 1992, almost 6 months after the Simmons sisters had made their complaints, authorities called the doctor's office to get Sean and Katie's medical records. Still, Dr. Joe seemed unconcerned. 10 days later, the doctor was advised by his lawyer that there were inconsistencies in the girls' statements, and it would be his word against theirs, basically. The doctor now told Shelley and others that he was addicted to sex and gambling, but he didn't tell them that he'd begun an affair with another teenage girl. This girl was allegedly handed over to him by her own father in exchange for some prescription drugs. How sad is that? This 16-year-old patient alleged that her father told her to go in there and do everything the doctor asks after getting a prescription from him. The doctor had asked her to join him for dinner that evening, and according to the teenager, he drove her to a secluded spot where he pressured her into giving him oral sex. Afterwards, he took her out for a pizza and then drove her back to the same place for another round of oral sex. It was gross, she recalled. The girl said she declined an offer to be a nanny to his children, and then she began working as a prostitute. She said she'd lost all self-respect and felt very used and dirty. Eventually, the teenager returned to the small town where her mother was living and then her mother and her went to the police to file a complaint. After that, her father had called and told her to drop the complaint, or the doctor was going to hire a hitman to kill her.
And I would probably believe that.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Now, in November of 1992, Dr. Joe was notified that the college was proceeding with the complaints made by Katie and Sean Simmons. A letter notified him that the college would hold two separate hearings, one for each of the sisters, on March 4th and March 5th. The hearings were 4 months away, but the Simmons sisters had waited almost a year since filing the complaints. They were certainly relieved, and hopefully they could put it all behind them. So Sean was still living at home with her parents, but Katie had been living for the past 2 years with her aunt in Surrey. The small house was closer to Katie's new job as a bank teller. She was working full-time and had saved up for a down payment on a Jeep. Then when they went shopping for the Jeep, they found two. So Sean and Katie convinced their father to help them purchase both Jeeps while the girls would work to make the payments themselves. To help Katie with her rent, Sean decided to move in with her in her basement apartment. Now, moving out was a big deal for Sean. She was a homebody, and even a sleepover at a friend's house could make her homesick.
Yeah, so it was a bit stressful, but she was really excited about it. These sisters were very close. So the entrance to Sean and Katie's basement apartment was a concrete stairwell that led to a foyer and then a living room. They had two bedrooms, one bathroom, and a small kitchen. They decorated the walls with family photos, making it really homey. There was no driveway access at the front because of the busy main road, so the sisters parked their Jeeps in an alley out back. The upcoming hearing was a dark cloud, but the girls were eager to put that behind them, and they knew they weren't the only ones. Recently, there had been shocking allegations against two other doctors. One of them was an elderly Vancouver psychiatrist accused of whipping female patients at his home. The other was a doctor accused of raping a patient after drugging her during a house call. So although Sean and Katie had a new doctor and hadn't seen Dr. Joe for more than a year, they were about to hear from him again. After receiving the notification of the hearings, the doctor had gone to Radio Shack and bought a telephone tape recorder. He looked up Katie Simmons' phone number in his medical records and phoned her at 2 p.m. on November 11, 1992. Katie was unaware that her former doctor was recording the conversation, of course, and he started out with friendly questions about whether Katie and Sean liked their new doctor. Then he got to the real reason for his call. "Listen, I got this letter from the College of Physicians and Surgeons. I guess you know about that, huh?" "Uh-huh," Katie answered. "Well, yeah. The reason I called is because, you know, I was your doctor for a long time." "Uh-huh," Katie said. "I never hugged and kissed you on the mouth, right?" Well, Katie understood now why he was calling, and she said, "I really don't think I'm supposed to be talking to you." But this didn't stop him. Joe continued to try and talk her out of her complaint. He said that she and her sister just weren't being fair to him. He said it wasn't the right thing to do, and he wanted her to think it over. He said that he had never touched or kissed either of them, and that he had always been there for them when they had problems. So as they talked about this afterwards, Katie and her father decided that the call was a blatant attempt to interfere with Sean and Katie as witnesses. So they went ahead and reported the call to the college. The doctor had told Katie that he wasn't angry with her, but he was actually furious. Back at his home, he rewound the cassette tape and told Shelley that there was no way to prevent these girls from testifying except to kill them.
There's the answer. Joe told Shelley that the college probably would either suspend him for 2 years or revoke his medical license. And I would bet that they would revoke his medical license.
I would hope so.
The complaints would ruin him financially. And if the college took away his license and never gave it back, it would be the end of his livelihood. The hearings just could not be allowed to proceed. "Maybe I should just go to the hearing with a gun and shoot the whole panel," he told Shelley. She was accustomed to her husband's threats, which included threats of killing her. He hadn't done so she wasn't sure she'd believe him now. But there was always that doubt. She had been wanting to leave her husband for years now, and she knew that he was not above using violence to get what he wanted. And according to Shelley, Dr. Joe became obsessed about the upcoming hearing. His attorney told him he had a 50-50 chance of keeping his medical license.
That's not super encouraging.
No, that's your attorney. He's supposed to be more upbeat for
Right, right.
So what did Dr. Joe do? He called his old friend Brian West.
Right, the biker.
Biker Brian.
So instead of focusing on his current patients, the doctor began stalking Sean and Katie Simmons. He found out where they were living and what they were driving. Shelley was aware of her husband's nighttime outings as a stalker, too. Sometimes in the middle of the night, he would drive past Katie's house and park a block away. Behind the house, there was a dead-end street. He couldn't drive back there, so he would walk back there at 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning to see what vehicles were parked behind their house. So he was able to identify the girls' Jeeps, and he also wrote down the license plate numbers. So his buddy, Brian West, agreed to help out Dr. Joe. He contacted a drug addict named David Schlender, who owed him money that he couldn't afford to pay. Brian West was an intimidating man and an ex-convict. He began to threaten to hurt or kill Schlender and his family if Schlender didn't kill the Simmons girls. West told Schlender that a karate instructor friend of his needed Katie and Sean Simmons killed to prevent them from testifying against his friend. West later changed his earlier instructions and told Schlender that he only needed to kill Sean, the girl who drove the red Jeep, and I'm not sure why they determined that just killing one of them would be enough. But Schlender finally did agree to kill Sean, and West gave him a handgun, a silencer, and some bullets. He also gave him $700 to rent a car, but Schlender spent that money on cocaine. Remember, he was a pretty serious drug addict.
Now, Schlender would later claim that he procrastinated until after New Year's in 1993. At that time, West told him to look at some pictures in the glove box of his car. They were all Polaroid pictures of slaughtered people. He took them out of the glove box and looked at them, then threw them back in. Pictures looked very real. And after looking at them, West told Schlender, "That could be your family."
Yeah, he's not subtle.
Not in the least.
So Schlender didn't see any way out, and he agreed to commit the murder. After that, he called Sean and Katie's number. He got the answering machine and hung up. Now, several times in January, he borrowed cars and drove to their house, unaware that his activities had raised suspicions in the neighborhood, especially with the neighborhood mailman. There had been a recent spree of break-ins in the area, so the mailman had written down the license numbers of the car that Schlender was driving each time. Now on January 26th, 2 days before Sean's 20th birthday, Schlender invited a friend over and asked him if he could borrow his silver blue 1984 Dodge Omni for an hour to run some errands. On his usual Wednesday off on the morning of January 27th, 1993, Dr. Joe told Shelley to go shopping with him. On their way, they drove past Sean and Katie Simmons' home. It was a detour, but Joe said nothing about it, and Shelley knew better than to even ask. This was a cold, overcast day, and Katie was still thrilled that Sean had just moved in with her. Getting dressed, Katie reminded herself that she needed to pick up a birthday present for Sean before returning home. And after Katie left, Sean got out of bed, planning to do laundry and some studying before going to her classes that afternoon.
And about a mile away from them, David Schlender woke up pretty tired and wasted after a cocaine binge the night before. Now, he didn't bother to shower or shave. He got dressed, freebased a little more crack cocaine. Then he left his wife in bed, went into the kitchen, drank a can of beer. Beside him was the garbage bag containing the Ruger pistol and silencer. He took it out and loaded it. Then he stuffed the gun into his waistband and walked out to the Omni. Despite the cool weather, he's sweating profusely. Then he pulled up outside of Sean's house and saw her red Jeep in the alley. Sean had called her boyfriend, and after chatting, she told him she had to shower. She would call him before 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and that's when she had planned to leave for school. At 10:45, Sean's mother called her from work. "I'm just going to have a bath and get ready for class," Sean told her. Since she had moved, Sean had phoned or visited her parents every day just to check in. She never did phone her boyfriend back as she had promised. He waited until around 12:30 p.m., then called three times. Each time he got the answering machine. By the third call, he left a message on the machine. "Well, I guess you're talking to your aunt and you can't hear me," he said, trying to keep calm. "Oh, look at the time. I guess you've already gone to school. Oh, well, I'll see you tonight."
So Schlender had come to the neighborhood. He'd parked the Omni on the street about 100 yards away from the house and walked down the alley, looking around to make sure no one was watching as he approached Sean's red Jeep. With his keys, he made a deep, deliberate scratch in the paint. The scratch was on the driver's side door, and he believed no one had seen him. So he walked around the house, climbed the front steps, and knocked on the front door. Gil, Sean and Katie's aunt, opened the door and saw Schlender on the front porch. When he told her about scratching the Jeep, she explained that it belonged to the downstairs tenants and pointed to the entrance to the basement apartment. After he walked away, she saw that the Jeep was, in fact, scratched, but she wondered for a moment where Schlender's car was. So she hurried over to the kitchen where she could look out the window. Overlooking the basement stairwell, she could see and hear the stranger repeating the same story to Sean. So Sean had been on the phone with her friend Kimberly, whom she'd known since kindergarten. They were making plans for the weekend and for Sean's birthday. Then their conversation was interrupted by a knock at the door. Over the phone, Kimberly heard a male voice speaking to Sean. "I accidentally scratched your Jeep," the voice said. Whoever it was sounded sincere and apologetic. Sean said, "Kim, I'll call you later," and hung up the phone. When Kimberly called back after half an hour, her call went straight to the answering machine. Sean was very protective of her new Jeep, so she had pushed past Schlender in her robe to look at the damage. She shouted at him as she looked at the scratch. "For crying out loud," she yelled, "how could you do this?" Sean was swearing at him, and Schlender got nervous. The last thing he wanted was to attract attention, and what he didn't know was that this interaction was being witnessed by two neighbors. One neighbor looked out of her kitchen window. She knew that the girl in the robe lived across from her, and she watched Sean hit her own forehead with the palm of her hand as she yelled at the man standing beside her Jeep. The man followed Sean back into her basement across the alley. Next door to Sean's house, another neighbor was changing her sheets as she looked out of a window and saw the man look up at her as he walked around the Jeep towards the entrance to Sean's apartment. So she got a pretty good look at him.
Now, Sean normally wouldn't let a stranger into her apartment, but she was preoccupied with the damage to her Jeep. Schlender asked to use the bathroom, and she pointed out the second door down the hall. In the bathroom, Schlender took off his jacket and pulled the gun from the waistband of his jeans. In the foyer, Sean sat down to write out insurance information, totally unaware that Schlender was creeping up behind her with a gun. Suddenly, Sean turned around to see him holding the gun to her head, so she dropped her pen and let out a scream. She turned and jumped to her feet as Schlender fired the first shot, and this was a wound that shattered the left side of her jaw. In a hopeless attempt to get away, Sean backed up, raising her hands defensively, as Schlender fired a second shot. Screaming, she lunged at him and kicked him in the groin. The second bullet went through her right arm and lodged in the muscle near her shoulder. As the shell casing flew to the floor, Sean was still fighting for her life. The gunshots hadn't killed her. Her Aunt Gil thought she had heard some muffled shots upstairs, but the silencer worked. Thinking that the sound was coming from outside, Gil dismissed the noise. And then, using all the strength he could gather, Schlender swung the heavy gun into Sean's head, and it hit her with enough force that it split her right ear open. So she fell to the floor, and over again, Schlender was swinging the gun, hitting her face, and gouging the floor. He pummeled Sean's face and head until she stopped screaming. Permanent imprints from the gun were visible on Sean's face and scalp. She was bleeding to death, and brain matter was coming out from between the fractures in the skull. Schlender ran, left behind insurance papers.
While crossing into the road, Schlender looked over his shoulder to make sure that no vehicles were coming. Then he got into the Dodge Omni that was parked on the opposite side. There was a lot of junk in the back seat of the car, one of the neighbors noticed as she watched him, and she thought he looked very suspicious. The mailman recognized the car from the last time when he had written down the license plate number, back when Schlender had made a kind of a dry run in that car. On the back of a flyer, the mailman wrote down what he thought was the number, and he put the flyer in his pocket to keep in case he would hear of any burglaries that had happened that day. Wasn't even considering that there might have been a murder. Now that afternoon, Sean's Aunt Gill went grocery shopping, and when she returned, she noticed that a light was still on in the basement. So putting her grocery bags on the kitchen floor, she called the downstairs phone, but she got the answering machine. So she went downstairs to check the light, and that's when she found Sean. Sean was propped up against the wall in the foyer, just covered with blood. It was a gruesome, really gruesome scene. So Gil ran back upstairs, and she called 911. Of course, Sean's family was completely devastated. Police spoke to witnesses from her neighborhood, and they located the owner of that 1984 Dodge Omni. The insurance papers left behind actually belonged to the car's owner, not Schlender.
Schlender really thought this out, didn't he?
It's a really poorly done crime, yes. And part of the way he did it made it more brutal, too.
Yeah.
Now, no one in the neighborhood recognized the photo of the owner that police showed them, but within days, the police made the connection from the car to the owner, and from the car owner to Schlender, to Brian West, and ultimately to Dr. Joe, and Dr. Joe definitely had a motive.
He definitely did.
Later, trial testimony would reveal that Schlender drank beer and smoked crack cocaine with his friend, Brian Cann, on the morning of the murder. He then borrowed Cann's car and made a trial run to the Simmons residence. He then drove the car to his house, smoked some more crack with his wife. Schlender then took the loaded handgun and drove to the Simmons house again. Schlender scratched the red Jeep in the alley with a key. Moments later, he was inside of Sean's apartment, where he shot her and bludgeoned her to death. Eyewitnesses confirmed seeing him running from the Simmons apartment on the day of her murder and driving away in Brian Cann's car. A day later, when Schlender was arrested, he had a large amount of cash on him. Turns out that Brian West had given him $1,200 after the murder and had promised him more money to come.
Now, Schlender claimed that he was only trying to scare Sean into not testifying against Dr. Joe. But Sean had panicked after seeing the gun and fought him. And that's when Schlender killed her.
I don't believe that at all. He shot her right away.
He told police that Brian West had hired him to murder Sean for a karate instructor friend. Dr. Joe had also recently renewed his passport and was planning a trip to Cyprus.
Interesting.
Something there, huh?
Yes.
So Schlender testified at the doctor's trial, and so did Shelley. Remember her, the girl he molested when she was 15 and married when she was 17?
Mm-hmm.
Now, when questioned, Shelley said that she had not known that her husband was sexually assaulting some of his young female patients and paying for sex with prostitutes.
Now, I had to go over this in my head a little bit. How could she be that naive? But then, when you think about it, she was just a girl.
Sure.
So I really can't hold anything against her.
No, can't either.
No.
She gave absolutely devastating testimony. She portrayed Dr. Joe as verbally and physically abusive. She testified that he valued money above everything else, abused alcohol, abused sleeping pills, and had a violent temper. She said that he would make death threats to all kinds of people, including Shelley's mother-in-law.
His own mother, yeah.
That's his mother.
Yep.
Members of the College of Physicians and Surgeons, David Schlender and his entire family, and police officers who he wanted to shoot in a donut shop. He had also told her he'd have a shootout with any cop who tried to arrest him.
God, this guy's just an asshole, let's be honest.
Yeah.
An all-round asshole.
Now, he had viewed his wife as his confidant and had shared with her some of his dark secrets. He had even threatened to kill Sean and Katie Simmons for causing him trouble. So Shelley's testimony was given a lot of weight and helped to ensure a conviction.
Oh, absolutely. Although there was a lot of evidence, Schlender was not exactly a brilliant criminal.
Right. He certainly wasn't.
So good old Dr. Joe was found guilty of first-degree murder for hiring the man who shot and bludgeoned Sean a few months before she was to testify against him in his sexual misconduct hearing. He was sentenced to life in prison. Brian West was also convicted of first-degree murder and conspiracy, and he was sentenced to life. In a separate trial, David Schlender was convicted of second-degree murder and also sentenced to life. Now, Schlender died in prison in 2006. During his time in prison, Brian West completed a lot of steps toward rehabilitation, and the parole board decision stated that he completed his correctional plan, he was compliant with rules, he kept a job, and he made meaningful contributions to prisoner advocacy programs. Also, he was treated for his drug addiction. So in 2013, he was granted day parole, which was a bit controversial at the time.
I can imagine.
So it was a serious crime.
Yeah.
But we know Canada is a little more focused on rehabilitation than we here in the U.S., so I think they give a lot more weight to that. Now, the Supreme Court of Canada declined to hear the doctor's appeals, of which there were many, and as is standard practice there, the court didn't release its reasons for making those decisions.
Just that they were not going to grant them.
Well, I really think he probably should have been kicked out of medical school years before that, because that contributed to his feeling of power and his ability to use people and manipulate people, absolutely. So I don't think he should have been in a position of power the way that he was as a person.
No, and the couple incidents that he had been involved in seemed to me to be enough to expel you from school.
Yes, I think so.
But didn't happen?
Didn't happen, and it's just really sad for the Simmons family especially. So TCB's music is written and produced by Tristan Capel. And if you have comments, a case suggestion, a beer recommendation, please send us an email to truecrimebrewery@tigrabber.com. As always, you can also record a voicemail that we might play on an upcoming episode, and we would love to hear from you. I'll include a direct link in our show notes for you to click on and record your voicemail, or you can do it on our website as well. If you would like to get all of your future TCB episodes commercial-free, get an extra members-only episode each month, and get a gift with a thank you note and some swag, you might want to think about subscribing at tigrabber.com. When you join, you'll have immediate access to all of our bonus episodes from the past 4 years or so, plus all of our other episodes will come to you without advertisements. So this is a good deal for anyone who enjoys our show, and it's an excellent way to support us. We also have a Patreon page where you can subscribe for ad-free and bonus content. And if you're interested in that, just go to patreon.com/tiegrabber to learn more. Also, if you enjoy our show, we would really appreciate your leaving a review of the show on iTunes or wherever you listen. I always read those, and we've gotten some really excellent ones recently that I can't tell you how much I appreciate. Now, one more thing. We're going to be taking the last 2 weeks of June off. So that means the next 2 weeks we won't have a new episode coming out. We're going to Maine to visit relatives who we haven't seen in over a year and a half, and I'm sure we'll miss doing the show, but we'll come back refreshed with all kinds of new ideas. Whenever we take a vacation, it's kind of a vacation, but we still do a lot of talking about true crime. We go on vacation, people want to talk about their kids or golf or trips they've taken, and I'm always like, yeah, did you hear about that missing woman in Colorado? Her husband looks really shifty. Also, we'll be checking our emails and voicemails from Maine, so please keep that feedback coming. So here comes Dickie, and he has a big basket full of feedback. What have you got?
I've got a couple of voicemails and one email. First voicemail is from Carol, and she has a case suggestion.
Hi, Dick and Jill. My name is Carol Gallagher. Right now, I'm living in Baltimore, Maryland, but I had previously lived in Lancaster County for 25 years. There was a really interesting case in 1991 of a young girl named Lori Show, and she went to Conestoga Valley High School, and it had some twists and turns, and it was just an interesting, very sad case, but interesting nonetheless. I think you might, you know, find it interesting. I'd like to see you cover that. I enjoy your podcast very much. I did want to ask you, where did you get the name Tiegrabber from? It's kind of interesting. I know when I type it into Google, it comes right up, so it's the only one. Not a beer drinker. Sorry about that. Can't refer any to you. But Anyway, that's it. Just thought you might like to check into that. I know you said you like recommendations. So thanks again for doing all the work. It sure is fun to listen to them when I'm working around the house or whatever. Thank you again. Bye.
Well, thank you, Carol. We do love to get feedback, especially voicemails. So we appreciate that a lot. And we love our listeners, whether they drink beer or not. At least I do.
Oh, of course.
Okay. So this sounds like the kind of case that we would cover. And actually, when I heard this voicemail originally, I thought, haven't we done that? But turns out we haven't.
Right. This is a 16-year-old high school student who got murdered by three of her classmates. It seems that Lori dated or briefly dated one of the boyfriends of classmates. So they got after her in a major way.
Yes. So this was in 1991. Lori was 16 years old. She was a sophomore in high school. And her body was found in her Lancaster, Pennsylvania home by her mother, Hazel. Now, Lori's throat had been cut, and classmates Lisa Michelle Lambert, Tabitha Buck, and Lawrence Butch Youngkin were charged with her murder. Police later recorded that Lori had a 5-inch gash to her throat, a stab wound had punctured her lung, and another stab wound had actually grazed her spine. She also had several wounds to her head and a lot of defensive wounds, so this was a brutal murder. So I definitely think we'll cover that. Seems to be a lot out there about it. It seems to be well known.
Yeah, and since then, two of the three people convicted have been paroled.
Wow.
Just the ringleader of the group is the only one still remaining in jail. But we'll check that.
Well, see, that is 30 years ago.
That's 30 years ago.
But I'm getting to the age in my life where 91 doesn't sound that long ago. You know, it really doesn't in my brain. But that is a while back.
It is a while back. Do you want to tell Carol how the tie grabber came up, or are you going to punt that one?
Sure. There is an explanation on our website if you go to About Us. But very briefly, we were friends and co-workers for many years, Dick and I, and this was kind of a later in life marriage. It wasn't a first marriage for either of us. But I saw him at a work party, and I might have had a few Red Bulls and vodka at that time. And what I did is I went over to him and I grabbed his tie and I kind of pulled on it. And that was part of my whole flirtation, which was really brilliant. It definitely worked anyway.
Well, it did work. That's true.
Yes. So that's where I got the tie grabber name. And I thought it would be original. And it is, because nobody else seems to use that word on any other website. And when you type it up, we're right there on Google. So that's nice.
There you are.
Yeah. But if you want the whole story, you can read that on our website. So we have another voicemail. And this one is from Nikki.
Hello, Jill and Dick. My name is Nikki Campbell. I am from Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. And I have a case suggestion. The guy's name is Blake Liebel or Liebel, originally from Canada, moved to Los Angeles to try to make it big in movies, but couldn't, so he started writing comic books. He got married. His first wife had a son. They ended up getting divorced. He got married to another lady, and she ended up having a child. I don't know what happened to him. I know his parents died. He ended up with several million dollars and went through them like water. But he ended up barricading himself in his apartment, talking his soon-to-be second ex-wife into going to see him to talk, and murdered her. It is a gruesome murder where he literally scalped her and took her skin off down to the jawbone on the right side, and it took her 8 hours before she died, and the reason of her death was blood loss. Didn't know if you guys would want to do that or not. Don't really have any beer suggestions. Groundhog brew is the popular thing here. Love, love, love your podcast. I listen to them on my 4-hour trip down to my girlfriend's and on my 4-hour trip home and all day long throughout the day. Keep up the great work and can't wait to see you at the quiet end.
Well, that was lovely with the little birds in the background. Did you hear that?
It sounds like springtime, doesn't it?
It certainly did. Thank you, Nikki, for your case suggestion. So, yes, I took a look at this, and it seems that after he had barricaded himself in his West Hollywood apartment, Leibel was taken into police custody, and they found the corpse of his fiancée there. She had been mutilated, drained of blood, and she was lying in the bed. Fortunately, their infant daughter was in the care of the victim's mother, who'd been visiting from Ukraine and staying in a nearby apartment. Leibel was charged with murder, torture, mayhem, and aggravated mayhem, and he pleaded not guilty. An autopsy report was released in September of 2017, listing the cause of death as exsanguination and head trauma. Now, exsanguination means that she bled to death.
Yeah, she bled out. I'm sure everyone knows that the head, the face is very vascular. A lot of blood vessels. What he did was basically not just scalp her, but peel all the skin away. So there's a ton of blood.
That's just awful and crazy.
Just sounds horrendous.
Now, I don't know a lot of background. I just did a quick look. But from photos of this guy, he looks insane. He looks like a scary individual.
Well,
which isn't surprising.
His actions would point towards insanity, wouldn't they?
Yes, yes. So one more piece of feedback. I have an email from Linda. Linda writes, I think you'd enjoy learning about the funeral home murders in Hudson, Wisconsin. Funeral director Dan O'Connell and his intern James Ellison were murdered at the funeral home. Very interesting twists and turns. Well, thanks, Linda. I did look this up, and the crimes in question are the murders of the 39-year-old Hudson funeral home director Dan O'Connell, and his employee was James Ellison, who was just 22. They were found shot to death in the funeral home in February of 2003, but because the prime suspect then committed suicide, no charges have been filed. So the prosecutor says he believes that Erickson killed the two men because O'Connell may have had information about sex abuse allegations against the priests or allegations that Erickson had provided alcohol to minors. It was school bus driver Mary Pagel who testified she had coffee with O'Connell in the morning on the day he died, and she said O'Connell asked her whether she ever saw the priest inappropriately touch a child. So he may have been onto something. O'Connell indicated he had a meeting with the priest later that day as well. Now, Erickson didn't become a suspect until nearly 2 years after these murders when he was interviewed by the police. And detectives said that he had information about the crime scene that hadn't been made public. So they went back to talk to him again in December, and 3 days after that, he killed himself. So they think that he did it. But just the whole idea of murders taking place in a funeral home is just interesting in some kind of level.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah. So yes, we'll look into that. That sounds really interesting too. Thank you, Linda.
Good cases.
We get a really high quality of feedback. I enjoy reading it. I really appreciate the effort that is put in.
Yes, it's very well appreciated.
Okay, so we're going to be gone for 2 weeks, and then we'll be back at the quiet end in July.
That's right.
Yes, I know. It's kind of sad, but I'm sure true crime will never completely leave our minds during that time.
Of course not.
No. Okay, thank you, everyone, and we'll see you next time at the quiet end.
We'll be saving some seats for you.
Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.